Hey there. Before we get into today's episode, I have a quick favor to ask you. If you love this show, please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us. It really helps other people find us, and it helps us know what you're liking and want to hear more of. Thank you. On with the show. This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, how Taylor Swift changed the music industry forever. In 2007, music journalist Rob Sheffield was in his kitchen making himself a grilled cheese when all of a sudden...
this country song comes on and it catches my ear right away. And then when she jumps into the chorus... our song is a slamming screen door. I thought, what a hook, what a chorus, what a lyric. And I loved how it was constructed so that she's a teenager and she's saying, yes, I've listened to every single song ever recorded. I'm an expert in music, but I've never heard a song that does justice to me, to my hopes, my dreams, my feelings. And so it ends with her saying, so I grabbed a pen and napkin and I wrote down this song.
I grabbed a pen and an old napkin and I wrote down our song.
I just love the way that that was structured as sort of her superhero origin story as a songwriter.
By this point, he was totally captivated.
I Googled to see who wrote the song. I didn't even Google to see who the singer was, because I was more curious, where does a song like that come from?
And as you probably already know, the songwriter was also the singer, Taylor Swift.
And I thought, how weird, because that just didn't happen in country music in 2007. And even weirder, this was her first album, and she was a teenager. And I thought, how did a teenager con a label into letting her write every song on her debut album? That's completely rare.
That teenager went on to become a singular force in the music industry, setting new records only to break them again with her next release. This year, Taylor Swift became the first artist to win the Album of the Year Grammy 4 times. And now her Eras Tour, which is set to end this year, is the highest grossing music tour ever. Now, Rob Sheffield, as you heard, has been listening to and writing about her since the beginning. In fact, he has ranked all 274 Taylor Swift songs for Rolling Stone. And now he's out with a new book called Heartbreak is the National Anthem, How Taylor Swift Reinvented Pop Music. We started by talking about what Rob says is at the heart of Swift's power and appeal, the true craft that goes into her songwriting.
First time I saw her, she was standing up there with her guitar and she says, my name is Taylor and I write songs about my feelings. And that's really what it comes down to. But she's like Bruce Springsteen or Smokey Robinson or Carole King and the all-time great songwriters who sum up a wide range of moods. Smokey Robinson, the best ever, when he wrote a really sad song like Ooh Baby Baby or The Tracks of My Tears, it was the saddest thing you'd ever heard. Or he could write a completely jubilant sounding song like I Second That Emotion. And she's got that same kind of range.
I mean, talk about her impact on the music industry. I mean, how do you sum that up for people who know of Taylor Swift and know of her bigness, but maybe don't know how to put into words what it is that she has actually changed and revolutionized here?
So when she began, she was a teenage girl with a guitar writing her own songs, which was so bizarre. People said, what a concept. What a novelty that this teenage girl is writing her own songs. Because, of course, there's a long tradition of teenage pop girls writing songs that are written by their male producers or male Svengalis. The great Debbie Gibson, big 80s fave of mine, who wrote, produced, and sang the number one hit, Foolish Beat, the first teenage girl to do all three. And she once told me about the experience of being in a meeting with the record company and telling them that she wanted to produce this song, and they all literally laughed. They just laughed when she said that. She told me, I can still see their shoulders moving up and down as they laughed. And this is what greeted Taylor Swift at the very beginning of her career. And she was doing it all herself. She had to fight so hard to prove that she was really writing those songs. And she was doing that as a teenager. And you look at what's popular in music in 2024, And it's all Taylor Swift's. You've got Sabrina Carpenter. You've got Billie Eilish, Olivia Rodrigo, Chappell Roan. You've got Charlie. It's this wide range of women who don't sound like each other. And none of them are copying Taylor Swift, but they're all operating in territory that she opened up.
I mean, it also speaks to just this incredible fan base that Taylor Swift has. I mean, it was apparent from a very early age. I remember the days when Taylor Swift used to host, you know, listening parties at her apartment and bake cookies for fans and send them care packages and things. I mean, that was really quite early on. And it, you know, things have changed over the years. But tell me a little bit about what Taylor Swift has meant to her fans and how she has grown such a loyal and close fan base.
Well, she's always understood the fans because she is one and has always been one. When she was 6 years old, she got Leanne Rimes' debut album, and she became a hardcore Leanne Rimes fan and was sending letters and pictures of herself to Leanne Rimes. And she remembered this moment from when she was six and she went to a Leanne Rimes concert, and she went up close to the stage and said, "Leanne, did you get my letters?" And Leanne looked at her and said, "I sure did, Taylor." She recognized Taylor from the drawings that Taylor had sent of herself. And that moment completely rewired the brain of the 6-year-old Taylor Swift.
Of course it would.
Of course it did. And I always think Leanne Rimes in that moment completely changed pop culture because she started off Taylor as a fan and really taught Taylor how it should be done.
Wow.
And it's funny that it's raised the bar so much. Now, romancing the fans like that is something that a pop star just does. When Taylor arrived in 2006, she was doing it better than anybody ever had. And she realized, because she was a fangirl, because she started out as a fangirl, she realized what they wanted. A friend of mine was interviewing her when she first put out her first album, and she was on MTV's TRL. I'm sure some of you out there remember TRL Total Request Live.
I'm old enough to know that one, yeah.
I love that. And as always, she's standing there in the studio, and there's hundreds of fans there, and my friend was watching her on her feet for hours as fan after fan, hundreds of fans, lined up to talk to her, and he noticed that she had a different compliment for each one. She would compliment something they were wearing or something about what they said, and that she always got their name, remembered their name, said their name, and he told me about it, and he said, "She's not like other teen stars. She's just not like other people." It's very amazing to see the energy that she gets from fan contact that for most pop stars is draining and exhausting. But for her, she thrives on that energy.
Well, let's get right into talking about her craft, which was on display from the very beginning. And as you've kind of alluded to, underestimated in many ways. Maybe let's just start by talking about some of her songs. Let's talk about Dear John. This is also really early Taylor Swift, a really early evocation of some of those feelings you're talking about, like what it means to be a teenage girl, what it means to be in love or think you have love and look back on that kind of young love, not with many years, but just in short retrospect, right? Tell me a little bit more about that song.
Dear John, one of my favorites. And for the record, I loved that song for well over a year before I had any idea it was about a supposedly about a real life celebrity.
John Mayer, which has been talked about a lot. Yes. Yes. Who she dated when she was quite young.
Yes. But I'm proof you can love that song without caring or knowing about that real life story at all. For me, it's such a beautiful song. It's so methodical, the way it goes through a relationship and her change of perspective about the relationship. At first, she's really blaming herself and saying, "I should have known, I should have known." And then it gets to the end and she starts saying, "You should have known." I just love that twist at the end. And it's also got one of those great Taylor Swift hyperverbal avalanches. I could just completely love the bridge where she starts out, "You're an expert at sorry, and keeping lines blurry and never impressed by me acing your tests." It's just beautiful that she makes it sound like it's just spilling out of her, like she's just making it up as she goes along. But of course, you have to be an incredibly calculating and gifted songwriter to create that bridge and still make it feel spontaneous.
I mean, Taylor Swift is the queen of the bridge, right? I mean, tell me a little bit about that. She's often credited with being able to write incredible bridges in her songs.
Yes. It's funny. She's the first songwriter who's made the bridges a signature in themselves.
Yeah.
The way
yeah.
that people talk about a Taylor Swift bridge. It used to be that that was just songwriter talk. That was just a phrase that critics and songwriters used. But it's something that she's made a trademark, and she just will go off in a bridge. She will change her mind completely about what the song is. She will write a whole new song in the bridge. Cruel Summer is a great example. Song is going. It's going. It's a nice, tight little pop song. Then she gets to the bridge and then starts a whole other song.
Yeah, sometimes the bridge represents just a total gear change where she can sort of switch into a different mode in the song, a different mood, a different emotion.
Yes. One of my favorite bridges ever is Long Live, which has two bridges, really.
Mm-hmm.
And she is basically breaking down the song and she's telling a story about two people having a moment of triumph. It's going so well. And then she turns to the boy and says, by the way, promise me you'll stay with me forever. Which is kind of changing the subject and changing the whole mood of the song. Up to that, it's just been exhilaration, exuberance. Whoa, we did it. And just switches to, well, okay, you'll stay with me forever. Promise me that. But in case we don't, then make sure you show my picture to your kids and make sure that they know my name. And I've got a little message for them. It's absolutely wild that she's got this song. It's already over. She's reached the ending and then starts a whole new song. And it's absolutely brilliant.
Hmm. You wrote about how after Red came out, you thought to yourself, this is it. She's found her sound. Why would she ever change? And then 1989 comes out and it is a totally different sound. Can you talk about what that album meant for Taylor in her growth?
Unbelievable. When she made Red, like you said, I thought this is a perfect album. This is the formula she's been aiming for. It's mm-hmm. like a little bit country, a little bit pop, a little bit rock and roll, a little disco, some dubstep. She's got it all together on one album. She's master of everything she tries. And I thought, great, she'll just keep redoing this album. I hope next year's version is almost as good. So when I listened to 1989 for the first time, and heard the very first song, Welcome to New York, and heard those synthesizers and those electro beats, and I thought, what is she doing? Nobody is asking her to completely change her sound. Walking through a crowd, the village is aglow. Kaleidoscope of loud heartbeats under coasts. Absolutely nobody was saying that that was a direction she needed to go in. And the songs are very much a drastic break with her past. There's no banjos on that album. There's no steel guitar on that album. Mm-hmm. There's no country on it at all. And she's just doing an entire album of 80s-inspired new wave synth pop. I remember listening to it for the first time with my jaw hanging open, and I thought, am I listening to my favorite songwriter completely blow up her career? And in a way, that's exactly what she was doing.
And the fans loved it. It was
and
very well received.
The fans loved it. Mm-hmm. She mm-hmm. had inspired this boom in young girls buying acoustic guitars. Music academies were reporting that suddenly they had 10 times as many girl students as boys.
Oh, wow. And the Taylor Swift effect.
The Taylor Swift effect. She completely restored the guitar to pop music. But for her to make an album that didn't have those kinds of guitars, really strange and really inexplicable. It turned out that the audience loved that. They loved hearing her challenge herself that way. That although it could have seemed like a commercial disaster, the fans absolutely loved that, and so did the world.
Is there a song you most love off that album?
Well, the song I love most from 1989 is the song that she left off the album, New Romantics.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, I love that song. It's just a perfect song about crying on the dance floor. And she's got a lot of songs about crying, and she's got a lot of songs about dance floors. But this is just a really great song that evokes that sort of chaotic time in your early 20s when you're so emotionally turbulent, but so determined to put on a brave face and fake it till you make it and strut like you're absolutely queen of the world when you're absolutely confused and messed up and scared. And to me, the thrill of that song musically, the way it goes into the chorus with that and a fantastic line in the chorus. Baby, I could build a castle out of all the bricks they threw at me. I absolutely love that. And something I love about that song is that it just did not make the album. And it was just a bonus track at first to special editions. But she seemed to realize very quickly that she'd written something special. She made it part of the 1989 tour. And she eventually released it as a single, which is not bad.
Yeah. Let's get into what you call Taylor's villain era and her album reputation. There's a little bit of pop culture literacy required here. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about what was going on at this time and sort of the backdrop of this album coming out.
It's very strange to think that just a few years ago when Reputation came out, Taylor was at her absolute lowest in terms of public esteem and public affection. She was in many ways public enemy number one. She had a feud with the rapper Kanye West and with his wife Kim Kardashian. It started at an award show in 2009, the MTV Video Music Awards. Kanye went on stage when she won her award for Best Female Video, and he came on and interrupted her with a speech about how she didn't deserve to win an award.
Yo, Taylor, I'm really happy for you. I'm gonna let you finish. But Beyonce had one of the best videos of all time.
And from that, even though he kept talking about it, she didn't keep talking about it. She didn't mention it for a year. But that didn't protect her from him reviving it in 2016 with his song Famous, where he has a lot of sexual insults directed at Taylor Swift. Yet the public was totally against her. And so it was strange when Reputation came out. It had a bit of that hostility, a bit of that defensive paranoia. But it turned out it was an album mostly of love songs. Yet it had that really cold, industrial sound. As Taylor once said, there's no wood floors on that album. That's an urban industrial cityscape. And it sounded completely nothing like 1989, her recent famous, successful album. And it sounded nothing like Red, but Reputation turned out to be a bestseller too.
And also, I mean, people don't expect a comeback quite like that, right? I mean, there was really a time right before Reputation came out where it was like, I think Taylor Swift might just be done. She's totally just disappeared from the public eye and seems to want to keep it that way and is trying to protect herself. And who knows what the next stage is going to look like for her. So, the bounce back, I think, was also very unexpected.
Very unexpected. And a lot of the album is about disengaging from public discourse, rewiring your self-esteem so it doesn't depend on public approval. So it's just you and the people who are closest to you in your life. And it's got some of her most beautiful love songs. Call It What You Want. What a song. I love that one. Delicate is one of my very favorite Taylor Swift songs ever.
Oh, tell me more about Delicate.
It's this wonderful song, very synth-poppy song about meeting up with a crush in a dive bar. And she's just talking about this really cautious, delicate situationship that they have, where nobody's making any emotional claims. However, she does have feelings. And I love how the chorus gets to, is it cool that I said all that?
Is it cool that I said all that? Is it too soon to do this yet? Cause I know that it's delicate. Isn't it?
Which is funny because after all her years of saying that, it's pretty clear that saying that is Taylor Swift's life work. There's just no question of, is it cool that I said all that? It's a bit late for that question.
Well, let's talk about the pandemic years and the shift to fictional storytelling that she took then. I mean, it was 2020 in the middle of the pandemic. Taylor Swift surprises everybody by suddenly dropping an album, Folklore. You call this her best album. This is also, for what it's worth, the first Taylor Swift album that I actually sat down and listened to top to bottom in its entirety. And I remember feeling, I mean, I'm the same age as Taylor Swift. And I remember feeling, oh, we've arrived in our 30s.
Yes.
Something felt different. Tell me about what you heard happening on Folklore.
Total transformation. That's my favorite. I think it's far and away her best. I love Evermore too, the sequel. But Folklore was such a complete gear shift. And also, it was not the album that she was planning to do in 2020. She wasn't planning to do any album. She was planning to keep promoting Lover, which was a very different album. It's so pop. It's got a lot of upbeat love songs. For Folklore, realizing that she wasn't going to be touring and that she wasn't going to be playing these songs in stadiums, she wrote really introspective songs, creating these characters, avoiding anything that sounded like pop or pandering to pop, definitely nothing for the radio. And she was working with Aaron Dessner from The National. She was working with Bon Iver. These were indie artists who had inspired her and had become friends with her, and that she was making this music without any real regard for what was going on in pop, and was able to create these characters, a lot of older women on that album, a lot of outrageous women on that album. She even has a song about a 17-year-old boy, which is a real stretch for her since she has very little interest in male characters.
She said, James, get in, let's drive. Those days turned into nights. Slept next to her, but I dreamt of you all summer long.
The cast of characters she creates on Folklore, totally wider than she'd ever aimed before and totally deeper. Mm. So to me, that album just completely stands apart. I got it that morning, the morning before it came out, and I listened to it for 18 hours straight. I was writing my review, but also I kept thinking, wow, this is her best since Red. This is her best since Red. And it took me a few hours, a few re-listens, maybe a dozen or so listens to concede, okay, this is actually even better than Red. This is just her best album ever.
Well, let's skip ahead a bit and talk about her re-recordings. For those who may not be familiar, can you tell us a little bit of this story, how she arrived at this place of re-recording her old work, and how remarkable the reception has been to her re-recordings?
Absolutely remarkable. She announced in 2019 that her label, Big Machine, had sold her masters, and she said had not given her the chance to bid on them. That was disputed, but they sold them to her very worst enemy in the business, Scooter Braun. And the fact that Scooter Braun owned her entire life's work up to that point is very upsetting to her. She announced that she was going to re-record all her albums so they could be hers. And it sounded like an absolutely ridiculous threat that nobody thought she would really follow through on. Even me. I thought, this is not the right use of her time and money at this point in her career. This is the world's biggest pop star. She says that in her spare time, she's going to remake her entire life's work. And yet, she not only got away with this, she made each one of those re-records a massive event in itself and was able to make them all seem like different expressions of who she was at that time by adding all the vault tracks, the songs that didn't make those albums. And people respond to that emotionally. I think people respond to the idea of going back to a moment in your past and sort of re-inhabiting it as an adult from an adult perspective.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you ranked All Too Well as the best song that Taylor Swift has ever made. And the re-recorded version of All Too Well is a great example about how going back to the studio was really transformative for her. Can you tell us about why that's the case and a little bit about All Too Well, Taylor's version?
I've always loved All Too Well. It was a song that she mentioned early on when it first was released that she had started with a 10-minute draft. And she had edited it down to the almost 6-minute version that you hear on the album. And it's very funny that over the years, people kept asking her about that lost 10-minute version. She must have wished that she never mentioned it. But it was something that the fans sort of opened her eyes to the idea that this was a story that deserved to be told at length. And it sounds like she is revisiting this story from her adult perspective. So we listen to the 10-minute version, and we don't just hear the lost verses or her adult versions of the lost verses, but we hear an adult in her 30s going back to a song she wrote in her early 20s about her late teens, early 20s. And it's really kind of amazing how much of that time travel is built into the song. It's such a journey in itself. I love that 10-minute version, but I've loved every version of this song. I love the short film that she directed about it. I went to see the premiere of that, and she showed up and she grabbed her guitar and she played the 10-minute version. Everybody sang along, even though the song had only existed for about 12 hours at that point.
And there we are again, when nobody had to know. You kept
Oh, wow.
It was
wow.
Just really beautiful. But the idea of this story that for her, for years, she didn't want to talk about this song or even sing it. She left it out of her next tour. She left it out of the tour after that. She just wouldn't play it live. She said it was too personal, had too many bad memories. But on that encouragement from the fans, she went back to a story that she thought was finished, and she opened it up because she realized that the song was in charge, not her. That whatever she thought the song was when she released it, the song had a life of its own. And she was just really taking orders from the song. I really love that. It's the central song in the book because, for me, it's the central song in her whole story.
Well, tell me, what has Taylor Swift re-recording her music done for her, and what has it done for the music industry at large?
I think it's shown artists how much they can get away with, and it's made artists evaluate the value of their songbook and the value of their songwriting and their publishing. But for Taylor to adopt such an extreme artists' rights platform, and she did that before the re-records. She was always talking about streaming and streaming revenues, and she was making that an issue years before that became a popular thing for stars to do. Taylor is really, really fond of taking up impossible challenges that any rational, sane, sensible person would talk her out of, but she's just determined to do them. As she said once at the Tribeca Film Festival, people often underestimate how much I will inconvenience myself to prove a point. And this is definitely a case of that.
Well, we have to talk about the Eras Tour. I can't let you go without us talking about it. I mean, Taylor has been on this huge, huge, massive Eras Tour since March of 2023, right? It feels like she's been on this tour for a very long time now. It winds down very soon. It is officially the highest grossing concert tour of all time, earning at least $1 billion in revenue. Talk to us about just how massive this tour has been and what it has meant for her and for her fans.
Yeah, the Eras Tour has been so massive. You mentioned the grosses. It grossed more in 2023 than the next two biggest tours combined.
Oh, wow.
The number two and three tours were Beyoncé and Bruce Springsteen, and the Eras Tour was bigger than both of them combined. For Taylor, this was something that even she, I think, couldn't have estimated, couldn't have guessed, couldn't have imagined that this tour would hit such a nerve with people. I think people loved the idea of the adult Taylor revisiting all her eras. There's a beautiful moment in the tour where she's going into Fearless and a lot of teen love songs in Fearless. And I saw her at MetLife Stadium in Jersey. And right before she begins that interlude in the show, she says, "Jersey,
you ready to go back to high school with me?"
I screamed as loud as anyone. I did not go to high school with those songs. I was out of high school by then. But for me, I just love how she adopted that sense of change into the tour itself, that going to the tour means living through all these different eras with her, but also living through all the different people that you were yourself when you listened to these albums.
Mm.
I love that this tour creates such a community, being part of an audience, seeing this tour. It's not like any other audience I've been part of. When I went to the tour for the first time, as soon as I stepped off the bus to go through the parking lot, total strangers were handing me friendship bracelets. It was just an absolutely incredible moment. It turns really these songs, some of which are the loneliest songs ever written, into these mass stadium sing-alongs in a way that is profoundly moving to hear. It also kind of changes the songs a bit. My Tears Ricochet is an example of a song where you hear it in a group of people who are singing it and think, wow, I guess I'm not alone in this feeling.
I mean, she has broken records at many of the stadiums that she has played on this tour in terms of attendance. I really like the headlines that I've seen about how some of her shows have caused seismic activity equal to a small earthquake in the places that she has been. I mean, it's amazing to talk about her in these terms. And yet I think some people still to this day, after all these years of her being at the top of her game, the top of the industry, kind of relegate her to a certain genre, a certain demographic. And for that reason, think that she's somehow a one-note artist.
Yes, I feel like there's a lot of people who will just never accept her on anything but the disposable bubblegum pop terms that they dismissed her when she first came out. I think, for me, she established herself pretty early on in her career. By her early 20s, as one of the all-time great songwriters. My last couple of books are about David Bowie and the Beatles, and some people have trouble with the idea of her being in that pantheon, but to me, she's right in that lineage. And she's also clearly studied both those artists and learned their tricks, learned their moves. But she was thinking, even from the very beginning, she was thinking in terms of history. She was thinking of making her mark on the long story of pop music, even when she was a 16-year-old country singer. I love there's an interview she did when she was 16, and she's just doing an interview. She's just released her country record, and the interviewer says, I noticed on your CD booklet, you have the lyrics of the songs, but there's some random letters capitalized. And she says, well, they're not random. If you take the capital letters from the songs and you put them together, they spell out secret messages that go with the song. So for one of the songs, it's Date Nice Boys, etc. And she says to the interviewer, you know, the Beatles did stuff like that on albums like the White Album, where in the 60s, you would play the album backwards and you might hear a secret message, or they might put secret clues on their album covers. And she said, so I wanted to do that. And it's really amazing to hear the 16-year-old country singer who many people would say has really peaked just by putting out an album of her own original songs, is already talking about thinking long-term in terms of what the Beatles did in the 60s.
Yeah, yeah. She knew her history at that point.
Yes.
And was like, I'm building that. I'm building something bigger than that.
Yes.
And look at where she's gone now. I mean, she's sent fans down rabbit holes and all kinds, following all kinds of Easter eggs and clues along the way for fun.
Yeah, it's really incredible. She is someone who has made mischief such a huge part of her music, to the point where we have no idea where she might go next. We have no idea what she might try next. I should know better than to try predicting her next move, because I've spent her entire career writing about her.
Yeah, sure.
And every time I try to guess what she might do next, I'm always completely wrong.
Well, make some wrong guesses with us. What do you think it might be?
I think she'll be back to music pretty quick. Some people say, you know, she's done this tour, she's put out these albums, she's ready for some downtime. I just think, have you? You've heard of her, right? She does not like downtime. She does not like taking time off. She's just not the kind of artist who wants people talking about what she did last year.
Mm.
And Prince was that type of artist. The Beatles were that type of artist. And Taylor Swift is that kind of artist. She does not want people talking about how good she was. She is determined to stay at that level. She sets herself insane challenges that absolutely nobody would expect from her. Her entire career has been getting to the point where she could just coast and do more of the same. And she consistently refuses to do that. And just really a continual surprise. Listening to her is just a continual surprise.
I know that you have, I know that you've met Taylor Swift many times. I know you didn't speak with her for the reporting of this book, but you have been backstage with her. What is she like in real life?
Well, I saw her on the Reputation Tour, first night of the Reputation Tour in 2018. And that was in Arizona. And I was talking to her backstage and she said, hey, just so you know, I'm doing All Too Well tonight. And she said, you changed my mind about that song because it was number one on your list, your Rolling Stone list of her songs.
Wow.
And she said, you convinced me that it wasn't just a Red Tour song. And so that night for her surprise song with her acoustic guitar, she did All Too Well. And
that's pretty major.
That was pretty major.
You changed her mind about her own song.
I would love to say that I did not shed a tear as she was singing that song, but I am not fooling anyone at all. I always shed a tear or two for that song.
Well, Rob, thank you so much for your time. This was really fun. This was really enjoyable.
Thank you so much. Oh my gosh, it is so fun talking Taylor with you. Thank you.
You can read Heartbreak is the National Anthem, How Taylor Swift Reinvented Pop Music by Rob Sheffield on Apple Books. You can also read his definitive ranking of all 274 Taylor Swift songs for Rolling Stone on Apple News. We'll include links on our show notes page.